I just wanted to say one thing real quick, and then we can kind of open it up for dialogue. And that is, when I started, I've been involved in the Iowa political, I'm young, so I've been involved in the Iowa political scene since 96-ish. And one thing that's frustrated me the most is that, unlike our liberal friends who share office space and share printers and treat each other really well, even if they fight like cats and dogs behind the scenes, they come out arm in arm outside the front door and have a press conference together every day. And they're just good at that. And we're so darn principled that we've struggled to coalition build in the past. Because when we disagree on one or two things, it's all said, now we can't work together. And that's always irritated me. But I think the best thing that came out of the 2006 elections, when Democrats took control of everything, is that it forced us to look at each other and go, well, we're all in the same boat. And we knew that. But then we had to put it into practice. And so I've been really excited to see this group of people in this room, along with the Catholic Conference. I wish Tom could have been here today. The Catholic Conference and Our Right to Life Committee and others kind of gel. And so I think if there's nothing that you come away with today, nothing else, it's that you have a solid group with APP and its advisory board and our organizations that we all represent to go to for resources and questions. And some of us are in the business of endorsing candidates. Most of us aren't. Some of us are more politically active as organizations and some aren't. But as a group, we can be a good resource for any candidate or any national public policy figure that wants to figure Iowa out. And so that was kind of the secondary point today, outside of education on who we are and what we're doing, is just to get a feel for our group as a whole. So I hope that was I hope we're successful in that in the next half hour or so before we leave. So with that, I kind of open it up to you, if you want to start a discussion, or if there's any particular thing that you're working on in Iowa, or questions you have about Iowa, or observations about what's going on in Iowa in the future, state or federal level, then we can turn that into a dialogue. I'd love it.
Well, all I would say is just listening to all of the different presentations, pretty much everything that you folks have talked about, those are areas that I've been very active on. I've been working on the federal level, obviously not on the state level. Everything from religious liberty, which you mentioned. I started a working group on religious liberty in Washington, D.C., and sponsored the Workplace Religious Freedom Act, and was very active on both here in this country and internationally on religious liberty issues. I think most of folks know my record on the life issue, and was the lead on the partial birth abortion bill, the Born Alive Infant Protection Bill, which Barack Obama is the only passed unanimously both in the House and Senate, and was the only person in the Illinois legislature to actually speak out against, the only person I know in the country that actually spoke out against protecting a baby that's born as a result of an abortion. Not only voted against it, but spoke out against it. And I would encourage you, if you haven't seen his comments, to read them. It's the most chilling thing you'd ever want to see. He basically makes the case that any child who's born prior to 40 weeks can be killed by their parents. That's the legal, this is our constitutional law professor's reasoning, and it's chilling. So I've been very active on the life issue. I'm a homeschooling dad. We've homeschooled our kids. We have seven children. We've been homeschooling our first children. We homeschooled into high school. Now we basically, because volume, we just homeschool through grade school, and then we send the kids off to schools. But I've been very active on the homeschooling front, trying to fight for homeschoolers. Very active on charter schools and education reform, generally speaking, and consider that one of my passions. Been active on pretty much gun issues. I've been active on that. I was the guy that worked with the Federalist Society in Washington, D.C., Leonard Leo, who began to make judges an issue in Washington, D.C. prior to the Bush administration, as you know, in in the Senate, we rolled over and played dead before I got there. If you remember, Breyer and Ginsburg were both almost unanimously approved. I mean, two left-wing, I don't know if you saw the 60 Minutes interview with Breyer, it's scary how left-wing these guys are. And they got virtually no negative votes. Well, John Kyle and I came to the Senate, and that changed. And I was the one that was one of the folks that led the fight on, if you remember, there was a series of appellate court judges, Estrada and Priscilla Owen and Janice Rogers Brown and others, and I was the guy that took the lead on that and then carried forward with working on Alito and Roberts. So very, very active on the judicial front, and as some of you know, I actually came here to Iowa and jumped on the judicial bus and did some appearances here to call for the voting against the retention of the judges here. I believe that's a vitally important issue, and was also very active on a lot of issues, which I talk about on Jen Michelson's show all the time, which is the right of the Congress to challenge the judiciary with respect to its assumed superiority with respect to saying what's constitutional and what's not. I supported amendments to restrict the court's jurisdiction. I've actually come out and said we need to abolish the Ninth Circuit, start all over again. Just get rid of it. I'm not for dividing it, I'm for abolishing it.
Abolish the judges.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, getting rid of the Ninth Circuit, firing all the judges, and starting anew, and reconstitute a Ninth and Tenth Circuit, a new Ninth and Tenth Circuit, maybe even 11th, maybe break it up into three, and start all over. And Congress has the absolute right to do that, and we should do it. So I can go on and talk about all the issues that you folks brought up here, but I think you'll find that Pastor, the issue of the role of faith in public life. I gave a speech in Houston, Texas. I don't know if you're familiar with them now, but I gave a speech in September on the role of faith in public life in response to a speech that was given in Houston 50 years ago by John Kennedy, who at the time was being questioned as to whether, as a Catholic running for president, whether the Pope would run the won the White House. And so he went out there and gave a speech in Houston where, unfortunately, he didn't just say, no, the Pope wasn't going to run it. He basically made a very radical speech that changed the entire dynamic in this country with respect to the interface of faith and public life. And you can trace the roots of this secularization of society and the privatization of faith to that speech.
Yeah.
And so I went down there 50 years later and gave a speech, which I encourage you, it's ricksantorum.com. You can go on there. If you don't want to read it, you can listen to it. There's a video clip. But it's a rather lengthy, somewhat academic. I gave it at St. Thomas University. It was co-sponsored by Houston Baptist and St. Thomas. Made the case that Kennedy's opening line, which was, I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, was his opening line.
Yeah.
Wow.
People don't realize how radical this speech was and how it changed the debate. And how you see all these Democratic Catholic politicians who are all left-wing, whatever the church teaches on faith and morals, they're on the other side.
Yeah.
But Kennedy gave them a permission to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And then Cuomo followed up 24 years later at Notre Dame to the day that Kennedy gave the speech. I mean, this is what the foundation that was built upon. So I go after Cuomo in the speech too. But
thank you for doing
that. I'm going to be very active. I mean, I agree with your overall understanding that there are not economic issues and social issues and foreign policy issues. They are all integrated. You cannot, and I talk about this in the speech, you can't have limited government without a virtuous people, and you can't have virtuous people without faith. And so faith is a key element of the success of America. I said this when I go to New York and try to raise money, and you go to New York and try to raise money, you don't talk to anybody who agrees with anybody at this table. They always hammer me, well, you know, you're a radical on, I was the promoter of the marriage amendment. One of the reasons I ended up in the last election cycle going out and arguing against John McCain is because I know what John McCain was like when I tried to push the marriage amendment.
Mm-hmm.
He about tore my head off.
Yeah.
And I continued to push, and we actually got a vote on it. And I continued to be very active. I had the temerity to speak out on the Lawrence versus Texas decision, and was almost stripped of my leadership position. The President of the United States didn't even defend me.
Yeah.
Bush, when I spoke out and said that if the court makes the wrong decision on Lawrence versus Texas, we will see gay marriage, we will see all these other things. And of course, I was right. Now, after the fact, several people have written articles. Hey, by the way, you know what Santorum said was right. But I've been out there and taking the leadership and, frankly, taking the arrows, both in the back and in the front and in the side and everywhere else, on all of these issues, and because I believe they're important to the fabric of America. I don't think you can't have a strong society unless you have strong families. You can't have strong families unless there's marriage, which is the glue that holds the family together.
Yep.
And I wrote a book about it called It Takes a Family. If you haven't had a chance to read it, I'll get you a copy.
I'd like to ask you a couple of things that I've heard as criticisms about you in the state, and I haven't researched them enough to know if they're legit. But I've got some friends at Iowa Right to Work who were, and these guys tend to be very, I mean, they're not going to be diplomatic about stuff.
Yeah.
And I love the Right to Work issue. But
Pennsylvania, by the way, Pennsylvania is not a Right to Work state.
Right.
Pennsylvania is one of the heaviest union states in the country.
Right, right.
And I represented it.
Right, right, right. So,
as the only conservative senator elected since the Great Depression.
You're starting to answer my question before I ask it. and there's two pieces to it. One of their criticisms has to do with, I don't know if it was an endorsement of
Arlen Specter.
Unionism.
No, I endorsed, that was one of the criticisms they always leveled at me, that I endorsed
okay.
Arlen Specter. But go ahead.
The endorsement of Arlen Specter, and then something about being pro or anti Right to Work. I'm not trying to attack you right now.
Jim, I don't support a national Right to Work bill. I think the states to make that decision. I don't think the federal government needs to get into that personally. I got enough things I get shot at about. I'm not going to take that on. I'll just be very honest about it. I take on the unions as much as anybody. I get beat up as much as anybody. I take on the teachers union. I take on everybody. There's only so many things you're going to take on, and I think you saw a pretty long laundry list of things I've taken on. To me, I just think that the states can handle that, and I'm trying to push a federal marriage amendment. To me, I think that's more important. I think the family is much more important. I'll take my shots as to what federal laws I'm going to push and what I'm not. I'm just being honest with you. I represented Pennsylvania. I mean, I had to get votes from pro-life union members in western Pennsylvania because half the Republican Party is pro-choice and against everything I stand for in the eastern part of the state. So I'm just not going to go out and poke folks in the eye. Just be honest with you. I just wasn't going to do it. And so I just said, look, on labor issues, let the state decide it. I'm not going to push any federal legislation. I'm going to remain neutral on that. I'm not going to vote for anything that's pro-union. My AFL-CIO voting record was always under 10% because I never voted for anything they wanted. But I also didn't try to push anything that changed the bar. So that's the position I'll take.
So where would you have fallen on card check then?
I'd have been against card check. That's just I don't.
That's
I never,
a national issue though.
I never vote. Well, I was against it.
Right.
Right.
So
I was against a federal
pro
law.
On the other side. Right?
I was against a federal law, changing the federal law. If the states want to pass it, that's their problem. So I mean, that's just I'm basically on that issue. I'm status quo, and you guys can fight it out in the states. That's sort of that's the approach I take.
Well, you mentioned Specter, and it does come up. So I just did you want to address that?
Yeah, very, very clear. Look, if I'd have known now what Arlen Specter was going to do, I wouldn't have supported him. But of course, with hindsight's 20/20. I had a situation where we had two Supreme Court nominees coming up, and maybe three coming up under the last term of Bush, and this was 2004, and Bush was running for re-election. And both George Bush and Rick Santorum went to Arlen Specter when he asked for our support and said, well, we'll support you if you can guarantee, as you'd be chairman of the Judiciary Committee, that you would support the president's nominations for the Supreme Court. We knew, and it turned out to be the case, that in order to get nominations passed in the United States Senate, Arlen Specter was going to be the linchpin. We needed to have not just all the Republican votes, and that includes, at the time, at least five moderates, but probably some conservative Democrat votes to get that done. And the key to getting that done was Arlen Specter's chairman of the Judiciary Committee being for the nominee. He committed to us that he would do so. He followed through with those commitments. I don't think anyone would question it. You ask Sam Alito himself. Sam Alito would not be confirmed today if it wasn't for Arlen Specter. Every time there was an issue that came out, Specter went out, batted it down, and carried Alito across the finish line. And every moderate and conservative, moderate Democrat or moderate Republican or conservative Democrat voted for Alito. So from my perspective, it was a 2004 election, and we were at a small majority. He was my colleague in the Senate. I'd served with him for 12 years. And I supported who I thought would be, on balance, the best for the causes I believed in. And while, you know, Pat Toomey was certainly objectively better on the issues, I would just, you know, point out the fact that in the greatest election cycle for Republicans in Pennsylvania in a long, long time, against a weak opponent, he won by 1 point. And our gubernatorial candidate won by 9. So you can say I made a decision. I made a tactical decision, a prudential judgment, as to what I thought would be in the best interest of the causes I believe in. And that's what I did.
I think one of the things I'll speak for myself, that I struggle with is we're all very principled, but there is a pragmatic side to this. And, you know, in trying to figure out how pragmatic can we be without compromising the principle, and I just appreciate you being real candid about that.
You know, they're all judgment calls. I mean, you know, my wife was on the other side of that issue.
Which one?
You know, she was for Toomey. She voted for Toomey. I voted for Specter. We canceled ourselves out on our own family. You know, I did what I thought was in the best interest of the causes I believe in. Period.
And Eric, hit on this, but as we go along and try to make those decisions personally out of our core convictions, never underestimate the ability of the political right, and especially the Christian political right, to circle the wagons, not to defend, but to shoot our wounded and eat our young. That's, you know, toe my line or you're a traitor. Yeah. That was a lot.
That's our biggest problem.
That's yeah.
I have to tell you, in Pennsylvania, no one in the history of Pennsylvania politics has ever, on a Republican side in the Congress, has ever taken on the life issue. Never. And I was the life guy in the United States Senate. I was the marriage guy in the United States Senate. I was the religious liberty guy in the United States Senate. I was the homeschooling guy in the United States Senate. You go on down the list. On every issue that social conservative cares about, I didn't just vote the right way. I led on every one of those issues in a state that hasn't voted for a Republican for president since 1988. And I won two elections doing it. I respect people who disagree with me, and I'm glad they hold my feet to the fire, and they have every right to do it. But just please take a step back and look at the bigger picture. And it's one thing to question my prudential judgments; another thing to question my convictions, because I think I've taken the shots for the convictions that I've held.
So, if you were running for president, and if the right to work issue came through and pass the House and the Senate, would you sign?
Sure. I don't oppose it, but I'm not going to propose it, and I'm not going to advocate for it. That's just, but I don't oppose. Look, you're talking to someone who believes that we need to relook at whether there should be public employee unions. If you're going to ask me to fight on any issue, fight on the issue. It's not the right to work issue, with all due respect. It's public employee unionism.
It's the only place they're growing.
Well, that's right, and that's where all the money's coming from, and it's coming from us.
It's our tax dollars.
So I don't really want to pick a fight. In all due respect, I don't want to pick a fight with the building trades. I don't want to pick a fight with the steel workers. It's not the private sector unions that are causing the problems in this country. It's the public employee unions or the mine workers. My grandfather was a UMW member. Okay, he was a treasurer of the union. So I'm not anti-union. I believe that public employee unions are an anathema. They don't make any sense. It's an unfair bargaining position when you have people on one side who's not their money,
right,
and on the other side are people who have every incentive just to soak the folks who don't care how much money they spend because it's not their money. the public official. So I think, again, going back to Kennedy, got it wrong again. He's the one that allowed public employee unionization. And I think we have to go after that. If you want to take on an issue that I'll take on with you, I'll join you on that.
Good.
I
totally agree with you.
I wonder why conservatives who talk about state sovereignty always want to give it up to the federal government and have the federal government pass a law that the states ought to pass.
A lot of these laws to me should be done on the state level and should not be federal laws. You know, if a law comes to me like a right to work law, I would sign it, but I think those are issues that have been state issues. There are some state issues that I think we should federalize, and one would be marriage, because I think you're seeing that a patchwork of marriage cannot work. That's so foundational of an institution that you can't have one state to another having different marriage laws.
That's actually a pretty good segue to what I want to talk about too, and that's a lot of us work on education issues indirectly or directly, and what we've seen up to this point, up to recent years, is a Department of Education at the federal level that gets a small amount of discretionary spending, and because they're legislatively prohibited from interfering with state curriculum and state policy making, they just kind of dangle a few little teeny carrots around for things. Then race to the top, and the stimulus package came, and now we're looking at billions and billions of dollars in discretionary funds, and Duncan out there saying, and I appreciate the fact that he is more reform-minded than most in the past. However, he's out there saying things like, you know, we finally have the tools to make change and things like that. And it's because he's got this giant negotiating chip to dangle out in front of cash-strapped states. And you can hardly blame legislators for being tempted to jump on this race to the top bandwagon, core standards bandwagon, which is something our organization's really concerned about, is a federal push for federal standards. I mean, education's not supposed to be a one-size-fits-all thing anyway, and we struggle with that at state level, let alone having a big federal one-size-fits-all plan for kids.
You've got a federal
kids.
Core curriculum coming down, what you got?
Yes. And so we've fought this fight already at the state level with the Iowa core curriculum, and we're seeing that's becoming a nightmare already, and now we're looking at a federal one that's overriding the mistake we already made. So I'm just wondering how you feel about that subject of the Department of Education and where you see that going with the current system and where you would like to see that go.
You know, one of the votes that I always look back on and question, at the time I questioned it, you know, I was in the leadership of the Senate, it was our president's big initiative, and we got a lot of pressure, and I voted for it. I voted for No Child Left Behind. I gave lots of speeches about federal intervention in education, and I voted for No Child Left Behind. But the reason I voted for No Child Left Behind, the principal reason is that we were going to finally measure. And I felt that it was important enough to put some sort of measuring tool in place, because every time we would try to do education reform, there would be all this information out there that says, oh, no, it's not that bad, or this and that. And it was always a confusion as to whether, you know, things were as bad as everyone anecdotally or otherwise was saying. So the one good thing about No Child Left Behind is now we know we're bad. Okay? Now we know we're failing. Okay? And so
that's valid.
Yeah, it's true.
That was the first time, because actually you were changing an act that was already there anyway. We already knew the federal money was going to go in there. And so our guidance counselors had to start talking about, instead of feeling good, accomplishment.
Right. Yep.
So you were absolutely correct.
So I even though I didn't like the heavy-handed aspect of it and some of the provisions, I come back and say the good thing that happened with No Child Left Behind is now no one can argue the facts.
Right.
And you're seeing things like Waiting for Superman coming out and some of these other things where even the left is now saying, because we now know we're a failure, that both sides are now open. So even though I still have concerns about that vote, I can say it accomplished what ultimately the reason I voted for it to accomplish. So the question is now, how do you go forward? And you know, my feeling is that, and I come from the standpoint of a, you know, homeschooling dad, is that the educational system is not there to serve children. It's a radical idea, but but it's not there to serve the children. That's not the client of the educational system. The client of the educational system is the mother and the father, because it's their responsibility to educate their children. Okay. And so what I believe we have to do is foundationally change our way of looking at what the educational system should be about. The educational system should be about servicing the needs of mothers and fathers as they try to educate their children. And I said, you know, I give this talk to homeschooling groups all the time, but I probably could give it more generally. To me, the perfect world would be a world in which in May or June before the school year, that every parent would come in and meet with either a superintendent or assistant superintendent or somebody and sit down, and they would have a discussion and say, well, here's, you know, Elizabeth and John and Daniel, and I can go on the whole list, but that's my kids. Say, you know, whatever they are. I said, let's take each one of them, and how can we design a program that meets their needs? Where are they going to go to school? What classes, you know, is it going to be the private school or the public school or home school or charter school, whatever the case may be? How can we design a program that takes their capabilities, their skills, and their unique learning needs, and maximizes their ability to be successful? And we work with the parents and students. So we do this to some degree if you have a special needs child. We do it to some degree if you have a gifted child. But to average students, we don't do this. We don't say, how can we best, you know, educate each child? And that should be the objective, is to deploy resources in a way that works with parents to maximize it. And I think, you want to talk about a revolution in schools, that would revolutionize schools. And it would make schools have to go out and compete for the resources where parents want to spend their resources, design programs to meet the needs of average kids, because that's where, by the way, that's where most of this money is going to go. It's going to go to the average kid. And the average kid in the school system today is left behind. They're the ones that are struggling, not the gifted kids or the ones that have IEPs. It's the average kid. And parents are not engaged. Parents don't have any idea what their kids are being taught. I know this. They have no idea what they're being taught in school, and because they're not involved. And so bringing parents involved, having the federal, state, local government telling parents, hey, by the way, this is your job. Parents don't believe it's their job to educate their children anymore. They believe it's their job. You know, we have politicians telling them, look, we'll take your kid at 2 and we'll provide universal everything so you don't have any responsibility. That's dangerous. You want to create little socialized, you know, socialistic kids, you put them in government daycare and government schools the rest of their life and be surprised they come out as liberals. You want parents to be involved. You want parents to be educating their children. So if you want my vision on education, that's it.
No, I think you just endorsed my book. Thank you very much.
All right, very good. Take whatever I said. It's recorded, and you do as a blurb if you want. So.
Senator, can I just, because I agree.
This is Kim
you.
Lehman, for those of you who don't know.
When I was fighting against human growth and development here in Iowa, which was instituted in 1986.
She doesn't like human growth or development at all. She's anti-human growth.
That's why, you know, you're against the Clean Water Act.
We've always known that about Kim.
You don't like clean water.
At least she's being honest about her agenda now.
Anyway, what I did is I opted my kids out of all the filth, okay? And I was like the weird parent. And the school was always having to deal with me. And here's what I believe is the reason why parents don't engage, because I was an engaging parent. I took my daughter, we were moving from Valley to Johnston, this is a personal example, and I was signing my daughter up and they're telling me what she has to take, what's mandatory by law, and they're telling me she had to take this human growth, this sex education crap, right?
That's what it is.
So anyway, the counselor said, oh yeah, she has to take that, mandatory by law. And I said, no, she doesn't. So I had to go to battle. I went in front of the principal, but before I did, I printed out Iowa code that allowed me to opt my daughter out. I highlighted it, I held it in my hand, and the principal told me that yes, she had to take it, okay? And I said, no, she doesn't. And I put that in front of him, And I said, you're not only telling me something that's not true, but you're a counselor. So I went to the supervisor of Johnston Schools, and he informed me that, yes, all of his, everybody knew that the parents didn't have to and the student didn't have to. And I thought, there's a real breakdown here, because what's happened is, because of the federal government laws, because of the state laws from top down, parents have been told they don't have an option. They don't have rights. And so the authority has been taken away from the parents because of the laws that have passed. I think if we really want the parents to engage, because that was bullying that happened to me. And if it wasn't for the fact that I just despised that law, I wouldn't have taken it that far, right? We need to eliminate the federal government Department of Education, period. Because the power that they hold over the heads of the parents. Because I agree with you, but it's not going to happen as long as there's those kind of mandates that they get to put in the face of the parents.
Yeah, may I have a couple comments before you start? I mean, that's, I think one of the big failures of the Republic, of the Reagan administration, was a failure to carry through on his promise to eliminate that department. I've read the Constitution. I've studied it in law school. There is absolutely no constitutional basis for the federal government to have anything to do with our education system. And that's, you take away the response, the rights from parents to do something, then it neuters their responsibility.
It did. Right.
Well,
that's what happened.
The reason I started homeschooling, at my daughter's urging, she had seen things in first and second grade that she knew in her heart and her spirit were wrong. They started calling us in for conferences, and we had to fill out a contract of what we were going to work with our children after school. Now, granted, they're on the bus at 7 a.m. If they're in sports, they get home maybe 5 p.m. If they're in music, that's after that. If they have homework, then there's a bath, then there's dinner. When do I get a parent, and when do I get to have any fun? And so I finally handed the contract back to the teacher and said, what are you going to teach my child this 9 months? But see, they wanted me to sign, and in front of my child, that gave my child the idea that they were the authority and I was somehow under their authority. And we knew at that point we had to leave. And what you're talking about with these conferences with parents, the individual plans for the special needs are horrible to get out of. Try and take your child out of that. They will all but arrest you and threaten you with the Department of Human Services. Mm-hmm. The school has to be reined in. It shouldn't even be funded by our taxpayer dollars. My child has to be on the bus at 7 a.m. if they're in public school, and they are forced to sit in the hallways in their snow-covered boots and snowsuits. They can't go to their lockers. They can't go to their classrooms because the other kids on the bus may want free breakfast.
And now I think it's our job to feed
we're enabling these non-parents at the cost of every parent who might have wanted to give their kids a warm breakfast. And I asked the principal, at what point are you going to start bathing these children? Because some of them have head lice every week. So until you call it for what it is.
It's coming. I like these people.
the delousing parties are coming.
So I mean, just when you're talking about your plan, red flags are going up all over, and I hope you all appreciate my restraint sitting here, because let me just assure you, when I walked into the school building, alarms went off. They knew who I was.
Yeah.
And the danger is that...
That has to change.
It has to change.
Not going to improve education unless that changes.
Yeah. Senator, if you ran for president, would your approach be incrementalism? We've talked about pragmatism. There is a time when you have to use it. But would it be a presidency of incrementalism in the right direction, or would you propose any particular issues that would satisfy those of us who weary of incrementalism because it seems to fail? Something like something radical like a flat tax, or, you know, abolish the IRS. That was Huckabee's line. Is there anything where you're proposing a leap to end the progressive tax system? What would you bring to the table that would that would really alarm the left. I guess that's my
question. Well, I think I would alarm the left, period.
But I mean really alarm.
No, I think I'd really alarm the left. You need to go back and read my press clips. I would alarm the left. You mentioned taxes. I haven't come forward, and I'm working on some things as far as what I would propose. I'm not ready to go out and make major pronouncements on economic policy or anything like that. I think you've heard some of the things I've talked about, some of the things I would advocate for, and I think they would be rather alarming to the left. On spending, I'm for abolishing Obamacare, not saving any of it, eliminate it all. For completely trying to restructure the healthcare system. That's at the core of the problem of the federal government's huge unfunded liabilities going forward is healthcare. It's mm-hmm. It's Obamacare, Medicare, Medicaid, and I'm already out there talking about what I do with Medicaid, what I do with Medicare, and those would be big. Those would be big issues. What I've said is that I would propose changes to the tax code that would make it a pro-growth tax code, and that we have to go out and cut back on federal spending. I had a gentleman come up and give me a pamphlet yesterday, and some other people talked to me today about some project that's being promoted to institute some management reforms within the bureaucracy, the Lean Six Sigma that's being used in the business community, trying to apply those principles to the federal government. I'm looking into that, but clearly trying to create efficiency within the bureaucracy. When I left the Senate, several of my employees went and worked in the administration, and the horror stories that they came back with, and just the number of people whose jobs it is to do the same thing, this is one of the big problems of Congress, the reports we require. I mean, the reporting requirements for every bill that passes, so we can find out, you know, how things are working, and these reports just pile. Nobody reads them. You know, people who do the job, they don't read them. I mean, they send them to Congress. Maybe some intern reads them, but you know, you have literally thousands of employees whose jobs it is to do reports that nobody reads. And so you just have to look at, you know, how are we going to put lead on the target? How are we going to, you know, have tasks and deliver services and quit worrying about process reports, and let's look at outcomes. And if the outcome's not working, then, you know, we'll know that. We don't have to have any great reports to tell us that, you know, people are getting through TSA screeners and we're doing it wrong, or people are, you know, we'll see from the outcomes of these programs whether it's working out. So I think that there's a lot that can be done, and one of the reasons that I'm contemplating this is because I believe that America is going to be in such dire straits fiscally that we're going to have an opportunity to do some big things, and we're going to need a leader who can think and do things that are different than the way they've been done in the past, and be able to communicate. I think one of the most important things that we miss out on as conservatives and as Republicans in nominating somebody is, and we all go back, and one of the why do we always harken back to the days of Ronald Reagan? Because was Ronald Reagan any more principled than most of the other guys that we nominated? I would argue maybe a little bit. But what was the real gift of Ronald Reagan? He was a great communicator. And if we look back since the days of television, the best communicator wins.
Yep.
Every race, the yep. best communicator wins. Not the best ideas, the yeah. best communicator. And so when you're looking at 2012 here in Iowa, and you guys, you know, are the HR department for the country here when it comes to president, when you look at that, you need to look at who can compete from the standpoint of communications to the American public with a very good communicator. And number two, if they're successful, who can then mobilize the American public, has that ability to reach out on television in a mass way to be able to mobilize the public to do things that otherwise they probably aren't going to be particularly excited about doing.
Well, I appreciate you coming today, and I just want to respect your time. We said we go till about 11 or so, and it's after that. But on behalf of American Principles Project and our advisory board, I want to thank you for coming and
Thanks, sir.
Participating. And as a matter of fact, I just thought of this, but it might be kind of fun if we. I'd like to get a photo of us. Is that all right? Just the.
Yeah. Anybody here have any criminal record or anything like that?
If we could do that, and then.